Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. This might be the golden age for nerds. Heavy glasses, once signaling nerds, are now the hallmark of cool. But think back to high school when being a nerd and what went along with it was not so cool. Debate club, band, an abhorrence of phys ed, teasing, and worse in the lunchroom. Benjamin Nugent's new book, American Nerd, part memoir, part history, looks back at two centuries of nerds. This hour on Point, the American Nerd, then and now. Joining me now from Santa Monica, California, is Benjamin Nugent. His new book is American Nerd, The Story of My People, which the Los Angeles Times calls one of the season's most talked about cultural studies. Ben, great to have you with us.
Hey, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So part history, part memoir, you say. When did you realize, with all due respect, that you were in fact a nerd?
Well, I think it was made abundantly clear to me by the other children when I was maybe 8, 7, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone called me a nerd when I was a kid. And actually, that was sort of the genesis for this book. I grew up in sort of Berkeley-like college towns. So, you guys are in Boston. I grew up in Cambridge and then Amherst. And these are places where the history of prejudice and categorization was a huge part of our schooling. And so I thought, where did this category I got put in come from?
If there's any place to be a nerd, it's there, I guess, right?
Yeah, it's really hard to not be tolerated in Amherst, but I managed it.
So it's all very entertaining, but it seems to me that your book really is a serious attempt to grapple with the meaning and the evolution of the nerd. Where does it start? Where did the nerd begin?
Well, before you have the word nerd, you have the concept of the nerd, which I think goes back to the early industrial age. This is what we call the Romanticist era, the late 18th century, the early 19th century. And what happens during this time is you get the first factory machines in England. And unlike traditional tools, these factory machines set the rhythm for the workers who are using them. So they're kind of thinking machines. They're nothing like computers that seem to really think now. But back then, people were really shocked by how much these machines seem to think. So while thinking used to make you human, while it used to be the quintessentially human activity, you couldn't think of thinking as what was most human anymore. And so what became human, quintessentially, in the Romantic era was spontaneity and love and emotion. And once that happened, you could say that people who were too much like machines, who were just too much about thinking and not enough about spontaneity and emotion, were this separate marginalized category.
So the dawn of the machine age was the dawn of the nerd, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I think you have to have machines to have nerds.
So what's the image of a nerd? What are the traits of a nerd?
Well, usually the people who get put in the category nerd, and I mean, we should, make clear that nerd is not a scientifically valid category. It's one of those categories like say white person that doesn't have any biological validity, but nonetheless is a construct that affects people's lives. People who usually get put in that category are people who at least give the appearance of liking to think systematically, of liking to think in terms of rules and logic, and are less comfortable thinking intuitively and generally to be popular in high school, for example, the kinds of things you have to be good at are intuitive. The rules aren't written down. You have to figure them out as you go. You have to make eye contact with people. You have to sense intuitively what people want from you. And nerds tend to be people who are bad at that.
The outsiders, if you will.
Yeah, a certain kind of outsider. Outsiders who really like logic and rules.
So what is the anti-nerd then? The jock or...
Sure. Well, there are a couple. There are a lot of people who hate nerds and could therefore be described as anti-nerds. But one of the ways we got the particular idea of what a nerd is in the United States comes from the way we defined the gentleman athlete in the 19th century and early 20th century as a masculine ideal. And you could argue that the jock is the opposite of the nerd for that reason. It was a personality type that people really strongly cultivated at a particular time.
On that note, I'd like you to read from the book, would you?
Yeah, sure.
Just from the very beginning,
where you talk about, well, yourself and what it means to be a nerd.
Okay, sure. Before I launch into a discussion of what a nerd is and where the idea of nerds comes from, I'd like to disclose that when I was 11, I had a rich fantasy life in which I carried a glowing staff. On Earth, I ran to class under an L.L. Bean backpack erupting with books that I was too distracted by my medieval life to put in my locker, as I was pursued by an actual medieval-style warrior society of lacrosse players. When I saw them, I would blend with the crowd or run. They, in turn, established a pretty good Nugent impersonation. You bend forward at the waist to signify the burden of the swollen backpack and stick out your elbows, funky chicken style, with your hands bunched into fists on your chest to signify the straps of the backpack clutched close to the body. Running through the halls with a backpack that was capable of doing real harm to others didn't do much to draw sympathy, so nobody raised serious objections when every once in a while somebody hit me in the crotch with a clarinet case or hockey stick. All of which to say, my journalistic objectivity with regard to my subject matter is seriously compromised, but I am trying my best. That means I'm not writing a defense of nerds, or a celebration of nerds, or a polemic against the nerd stereotype. There is a rationale, I think, for despising the young me. I empathize with nerds and anti-nerds alike.
So with that mix of sympathies, what did you set out to explain?
I set out to explain where we got this type from, you know, how the things that happened in the 19th and 20th centuries freaked people out about technology and the machine and new ways of living, and so that they created this type, the nerd, to kind of explain the people who they felt were responding to modernity the wrong way, were becoming too mechanized, were becoming too rational, weren't physical enough, weren't primitive enough. And then, of course, in the 20th century, you get people who become proud of being nerds. And, you know, it's nerds themselves who create a lot of the pop culture images we have of nerds.
Right. It's almost fashionable to claim that you're a nerd, right? Pocket protectors and tape holding together the glasses and all.
Yeah, well, I think it has become fashionable to say you were a nerd in high school. Absolutely.
Nerd chic? Is that what they call it now?
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, one chapter I have is called The Cool Nerd. And it's about neighborhoods like Williamsburg in New York City or Echo Park in Los Angeles, where a certain kind of look, people often call it hipster, is prevalent. And it's basically a way of kind of doing a really conspicuously nerdy set of signifiers, like huge black glasses and short pants and stuff like that, but in such a way so that you can tell it's totally deliberate and calculated and done with a sense of grace and fashion. And so it's a really interesting idea that you can affect nerdiness, because the whole idea about nerds is that they're not very good at controlling their presentation of themselves. And so it's almost a way of being super cool to dress conspicuously nerdy these days.
You know, you talk about grace and fashion, and I wonder, you know, you tend to think of boys as nerds. Is the term gender specific?
No, I don't think it is. There are a lot of girl nerds. And in fact, you know, some of the most prevalent images we've had of nerds over the last 30 years or so have been the nerd sketches on Saturday Night Live.
Right.
That was, you know, Lisa Loebner and
Todd. Gilda Radner, right?
Yeah, Gilda Radner played Lisa Loebner and Bill Murray played Todd.
Right.
And those were written by two women, Ann Beatz and Rosie Schuster, who were writers on the show and who had both been nerdy girls in junior high and high school and were drawing on those experiences.
Got easy laughs, great laughs. You also track some nerds in, well, wonderful literature, Pride and Prejudice, nerdy characters there as well.
That's right. In fact, one of the earliest nerds I was able to find in literature was Mary Bennett, the younger sister of Elizabeth Bennet, the main character. Mary Bennet is extremely pedantic, and she has a lot of technical skill. She's really good at playing piano, but when Elizabeth then follows her playing piano at the Meryton Assembly, everybody likes Elizabeth's piano playing much better, because Elizabeth has a sense of art and grace and intuition about how to put emotion into the piano. But Mary just keeps kind of lecturing people and trying to get things exactly right in this very funny way.
Dr. Seuss actually made use of the word, in the 50s?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in 1950, the first known printed use of the word nerd was in Dr. Seuss's 1950 book, If I Ran the Zoo. And it was the name for a kind of agitated-looking little creature that looked frustrated that it wasn't larger. But it didn't look like a nerd the way we know a nerd now.
And you can't forget about the nerd in Frankenstein, right? The science mad Victor.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Frankenstein by Mary Shelley came out about the same time as Pride and Prejudice, I think in 1813. And Victor Frankenstein was very much a nerd, and I think one of the first great nerds we find in literature. And he locked himself up in a tower and longed to, quote-unquote, penetrate the secrets of nature. And it was sort of this drive to isolate himself and make the lab all that was real. And then when he actually succeeds in creating a human because he's so good at science, as soon as the thing opens its eyes, we're talking about Frankenstein's monster, so-called here, he freaks out and he goes, oh my God, it's so ugly, I can't deal with this thing, and runs away and abandons it. And so it's sort of this ability to do something really complicated with science, coupled with an inability to be a parent or a good steward or to have empathy for this thing.
We're talking about nerds and their place in American culture. More to come on this. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
The theory is that all matter is composed of at least three fundamental particles, protons, electrons, neutrons. Protons are charged positive. By now, you guessed electrons are probably negatively charged. Neutrons don't follow either. Neutral in the middle. Only no apology. Centered, unmoved by yin and yang ideology. Neutron bombs, arms, electron theory. Cosmic musical radio activity. Different points and joints within.
We're talking about the American nerd today and throughout history. Does a love for Dungeons and Dragons mark you as a nerd? Is the nerd badge one you wear with pride? My guest today is Ben Nugent, author of the new book, American Nerd, The Story of My People. I want to get some calls in. They're lining up, and we want to get to you. Rachel is first from Hartford, Connecticut. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Are you a nerd, Rachel?
Oh, yes. I am definitely a nerd. I'm a math professor, and I'm proud to be a nerd. All of my friends are nerds. I guess I have points. The first thing is what your speaker was saying about a love of logic and rules. Oh, I can relate to that completely. And then the other couple things I wanted to say was, I guess right around the time when I was 15, I think I made a transition from an old-fashioned nerd to like a modern nerd.
Ah, an old-fashioned nerd to a modern nerd.
Yeah, and then the other thing I wanted to say is that I think modern nerds are intimidating to people because they are not necessarily social outcasts anymore, you know. They know how to dress, they know how to socialize, but they're still smart, and people can be intimidated by that because they think that they shouldn't be able to do it all, I guess.
Mm. Interesting point, Rachel. Thank you. Ben Nugent, what do you think about that? I mean, gosh, some of the great nerds, you know, Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, Alan Greenspan, nerds are taking over the world, huh?
Well, yeah, the person she just described does sound intimidating, a smart, well-dressed person. I guess that never goes out of style. I think, you know, what has happened is nerds have become economically ascendant, that, you know, what used to be the assumed characteristic of a great business leader was a kind of animal magnetism and charisma and classic leadership skills to get people to follow you. And with guys like Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, of course, no matter how many skills they might have socially or not have, what they really bring to the table is technological genius and innovation.
Right.
And the fact that these are the richest guys is a huge change. And so I think that economic rise has been accompanied by a rise in prestige in our culture.
Mm. Another call now from Joe, who's in Grafton, Massachusetts. Hi, Joe. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
Yes, I'd like to get into the subcategories of nerds. I mean, well, as you mentioned, Bill Gates, I mean, basically he's a geek dealing with technology, and Alan Greenspan is a nerd, is basically a nerd for dealing with mathematics and economics. And then we have policy wonks who are also nerds, but their nerdiness brought them into public service. So there's different subsets within nerddom.
Thank you for bringing that up, Joe. The subcategories, the subsets, Ben Nugent. Well, what's the difference, first of all, between a nerd and a geek? Question I never thought I would ask as a journalist, but here we go.
Yeah, I'm glad you are. Well, you know, I think they're often used interchangeably, but then they're also often used differently, too. And I think the reason is that even though geek is actually an older term, geek is an early 20th century term for a guy at a traveling carnival who bites the heads off chickens. Ironically, actually, the idea was the geek had so few intellectual abilities or skills that all he could do was bite the head off of a chicken to have a job. But now geek almost means the opposite. Because it was a term that became fashionable when Silicon Valley was in the media a lot for the first time in the 80s, I think we tend to think of it more associated with technology and skill than we think of the term nerd as being. I think we usually use the word nerd a little more to refer to a social outcast, and we use the term geek a little more to refer to somebody who is skilled at something, who quote-unquote geeks out on something.
So let's really get this straight. Nerds are geeks with better grades? Is that right?
I don't think that's true, actually, no. I think geek, because it didn't come into style as a word until the 80s, tends to have more Silicon Valley implications, and therefore we tend to think of it as being more about tech and skill.
I see. Jay has a question from Chesapeake, Virginia. Hi, welcome to the program, Jay.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a comment. My comment is, when I think of nerd, I think of the original incarnation, which to me is a bookworm, somebody who would rather go to the library or sit under the tree with a book. And when I think of that, I think of the classic Twilight Zone episode about the bank teller with the thick Coke bottle glasses who sneaks away during his lunch break to read a book, and then a nuclear bomb goes off, and he emerges from the bank vault and stumbles upon the library, and he thinks he's in heaven, only to have his glasses fall off his face and break. But that was my comment, is that isn't a bookworm like the original nerd? And I'll listen up off the phone.
Jay, thanks. Ben, what about it?
Well, I think, book learning is sure can be a really nerdy thing. On the other hand, the interesting thing about that is that, you know, book learning and love of books by itself isn't enough to make you a nerd. I think, you know, you can think about these extremely literary people like Ernest Hemingway, who I'm pretty sure we wouldn't describe as nerds. And so I think not only is it the liking the books, but it's liking the books and being really psyched about a scenario in which there are no other humans left in the world and you're by yourself in a library. I would say that's what makes that guy a nerd.
Read another bit from the book, would you, Ben? The mark of greatness, a geek.
Sure.
Nerd.
On a soccer field beside a nature preserve, a dozen boys stand in a circle holding lengths of piping converted into blunt weapons. A brisk wind sings through the dying leaves. These are the last days of fall in Amherst, Massachusetts, and the chill puts us in an Arthurian cast of mind. There are a few smiles and a ring of scrofulous faces. We know this is not serious, but for some reason we are serious. Our weapons are called boff swords, our purpose here, boffing. To craft the instruments in our hands, we've purchased PVC pipe from Aubuchon Hardware at the Despondent Mall off Route 9, encased the ivory plastic tube with soft pipe insulation, and sealed together the bludgeon with duct tape. We're about to fight a melee, last man standing. Get hit in the arm, you lose the use of that arm. Lose one leg, you hop. Lose both, and you are on your knees. A hit to the skull or torso, and you fall dead. For a moment, there is no sound but the inconsolable wind. Then John L., with his freckles and his orange vest, looks at each of us and speaks calmly. 1, 2, 3. Nobody is so naive as to rush into the center. We all want to win. Some boys back up and walk sideways in order to stab somebody from behind. Some boys move with two hands on a long sword trembling 4 feet before them. Some wave two shorter swords, some a sword and shield. We are 13, 14. It's possible for each of us to believe that, for all intents and purposes, this soccer field might as well be a glade set aside for the resolution of disputes among the aristocracy of the sword. If the sons of the Prince of Wales had fallen into a conflict over farmland in the 13th century, we reason, it would have looked like this, basically.
You know, I'm interested to hear some of the field work that you did for this book, hearing that that clip. Take us to some of the nerd hangouts that you found, nerd landmarks, if you will. Start in L.A. at the Science Fantasies Society in North Hollywood. What was that like?
Sure. Well, the Los Angeles Science Fantasy Society is a really great monument to a certain time in nerd history, I think, and still very much functional. Basically, it's a clubhouse that serves no other function. That's all the building is there for. It has its own sign and an emblem. It still has the parking lot signs for Robert Heinlein back when he was around, and he was a member. And they get together there, and they talk about books and TV shows and movies that they like. And it also has almost a spiritual component. People sit around and kind of memorialize, eulogize members who have recently deceased or who are sick or having trouble, or writers who have recently died who they were fans of. And it almost reminded me of a Quaker meeting house in some ways, in that people would just kind of say what came to them. And it was a very emotional place. Hmm. And what I thought was so interesting about it was the reason they have an aging membership is because nerds don't need to gather in a physical location anymore to find each other. They find each other online.
They can
find each other, you know, and talk on headsets playing World of Warcraft. And so I think it was a really touching reminder that nerds have lost something with the internet, even as much as they've gained, that while there's so many more of them they can be in touch with right now and not ever feel lonely or isolated in that way, they've lost that physical contact with each other that I think even nerds really like.
The gathering.
Yeah.
Kathleen is on the line from Marblehead, Massachusetts. Hi, Kathleen. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. How are you?
Hi, good.
I just wanted to ask a question and pass along a thought. The first is, I'm a parent of a son with Asperger's syndrome, and I think this is probably the best time ever in history to be a nerd, just because the world has become so technologically oriented. But I'm also curious, I don't know what you know about Asperger's, but I'm wondering if you'd be able to comment on the connection, or if there's even a discrepancy between Asperger's syndrome and nerddom.
Kathleen, thanks so much. Actually, this was a fascinating piece of your book, Ben, where you explore the relationship between nerdiness and Asperger's syndrome. What did you find?
Yeah, it's a chapter in my book, and I talked to a bunch of Asperger's psychologists, and you know, nerdiness and Asperger's syndrome aren't the same thing. I mean, Asperger's syndrome is a legitimate diagnosis in the DSM-4, and nerdiness is kind of a vernacular category that we've developed with folk wisdom over the years. But they're very similar in that the people we tend to call nerds are people who like to think systemically and tend to have trouble with thinking that is more intuitive and social and grounded in empathy. People with Asperger's syndrome and people who tend to get called nerds alike have trouble just sensing what other people want from them socially, even though they might be great at math and science and reason. And so there's a large overlap between Asperger's and nerdiness, but I'd say the biggest difference maybe is that Asperger's syndrome refers to a neurological state that, for better and for worse, usually people with Asperger's syndrome are hardwired, if you will, to be really good at systematic ways of thinking.
Systems and rules.
Exactly. And to be not as good, not so great usually, at just sensing what they're supposed to do in a particular situation. Things like eye contact and polite conversation come more they have to learn those by rote a little more, depending on how severe the Asperger's is. And so, you know, we're talking about like a Venn diagram where they overlap strongly, but nerdiness can be a temporary condition. It doesn't have to be neurologically hardwired.
So interesting. Fred is in Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Fred. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. Thank you, Jane, Ben, listeners. I'm wondering if the book addresses the larger social and cultural trends that have made nerds acceptable. If there are any historical corollaries, contemporary or over the long term. And my second question is, as nerds are becoming more socially dominant, will they still be nerds?
All right, Fred, thank you. Ben, what do you think?
I think, you know, even though nerds are carving out a place in our social hierarchy that's much higher than it used to be, I suppose, that nerds still very much are nerds in that we all go through this time of life called junior high and high school where we're not celebrated according to our ability to solve logical problems and perform as employees following rational rules. I think nerds are often people who are really well suited to certain work environments, but not as well suited to the social vagaries of junior high. And so I think we'll always have this sort of trial by fire for our nerdiest citizens. And I hope that trial that takes place from between, say, age 11 to age 17 doesn't continue to be as harsh as it has been in the past. We can keep our fingers crossed.
Ben, you actually tracked down two of your junior high school nerd friends, as you call them in the book. Tell us what you found.
You know, I was kind of testing the cliched story of the nerd who is unsuccessful socially in junior high and then takes revenge, quote unquote, by becoming Bill Gates or becoming some kind of tech genius who makes a lot of money and uses his nerdy skills to kind of get back at the world. And what I found was actually very different. When I went back and talked to a couple of my nerdy friends from junior high, nerdiness had played a really important role in their lives and had been really an important support system for them in a lot of ways. But their lives didn't follow that hackneyed Bill Gates path either. You know, one of them is an executive at a company that makes video games, and the other doesn't do anything professionally that has to do with nerdy stuff, but still plays role-playing games, still reads science fiction and fantasy, and still a big part of his life. And for both of them, in high school, they came from kind of chaotic family situations, single parent, you know, kind of troubled, moving around a lot, family situations. And, you know, this was a completely rational world they could escape into. You know, if they were, you know, frightened by their home lives, they couldn't control anything going on with their parents and their home, they could play D&D and utterly control their own destiny and, you know, have a invincibility about them that they couldn't have in real life and a competence in control.
I have about 30 seconds, but one of your friends had the idea of tracking down a couple of the other nerds, and one thought he wasn't a nerd at all. In fact, you thought he was a bully, but he thought of himself as a nerd, right?
Oh, well, yeah, you know, my friend who writes for the LA Times, you know, and I were talking about what he could do to write a story about me in this book, and he thought, why don't you track down a couple of the kids who bullied you when you were a kid? And one of them I tracked down on MySpace. It was really easy. And he was like, oh, yeah, you're interviewing me because I was a nerd, right? And it was an interesting Chekhovian moment, I guess, because as it turned out, everybody sort of thought of themselves as an outcast. Everybody probably, not everybody, but a lot of people had some figure in their lives they thought of as a bully and regarded themselves as the underdog.
We head over to Denny's where we smoke and we flirt. Well, I never do nothing. See, I'm kind of a nerd. Don't drink, don't smoke. A cigarette in half. I'm a drug-free virgin. I don't fit into the pack. They can tell that I am different and they love me for that. Always good for a laugh. Always paying for gas. I'll take a cup of
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about nerds and 200 years of nerd lore in American culture. My guest today is Ben Nugent. His new book is American Nerd, The Story of My People. Lots of great calls. Let's get to them. First up here, Nancy is in Queensboro, New York. Hi, Nancy. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to say I came from a... I didn't realize that they were nerds at the time. But in the early 80s, and they made their own drugs. Like, they were an elite crowd in my school, and they played chess, and they were always into the most different things. And they had kind of evolved out of D&D. And some of them worked for the government, making satellites, and some of them didn't make it. But I didn't realize that that's what they were and we were at the time. And that's all I wanted to say.
Nancy, thank you. Ben?
Made their own drugs. Wow.
That's not
a
in your book.
That's a level of nerdiness I've never heard of before. That's very, you know... innovative, I suppose.
You know, you actually write pretty extensively in your book about how race and ethnicity intersect with nerd identity. And I wonder if you'd talk about some of those stereotypes and how they're alive today.
Sure. Well, basically, the idea, this concept of the nerd and various ethnic stereotypes, mostly of Jews and Asians in the United States, share some common ancestors, basically. You know, if you look at the ways Jews, for example, were stereotyped in the 18th and 19th century in caricature, it's very similar to the way modern nerds are depicted. You got these extremely unathletic, bespectacled, scrawny people with kind of limbs wildly going all over the place, often falling off of bicycles. That was a motif in anti-Semitic caricature in the 18th and 19th century. And the idea was this was an ethnicity that was rational and calculating and smart, but was unable to engage in physical confrontation of any kind or to be physically graceful. And this was a big theme in anti-Semitism in the 18th and 19th centuries and into the 20th century, obviously. And interestingly, the stereotypes of Asians in the United States have had a lot in common with the stereotypes of Jews. And what they had in common specifically was the term inoffensive and cowardly. You know, when Mark Twain wrote about Chinatowns on the West Coast, he talked about how inoffensive and industrious they were. And they were portrayed in minstrel shows as being asexual and being the opposite of the Native American, who is considered like the manly alternative rooted in American soil. And the white man got to be right between this primitive Native American and this asexual Asian. And those stereotypes kind of transformed into stereotypes of nerds in the 20th century. You know, you see it explicitly in some 80s teen comedies where there are a lot of Asian nerds who are really good in school and are kind of beloved and by parents, and, you know, the parents approve of them, but the white girls they want to be with find them disgusting. They think they have, like, no sex appeal even though they're good at school. And what's interesting about how the Jewish stereotypes gradually segged into the nerd, which I think has no ethnic associations. I don't think when people think nerd these days, they think Jew, for example. But visually, they're very similar, and they played similar roles in our culture. What Lewis Skolnick, for example, the character in Revenge of the Nerds, signifies is a kind of, like, cowardly, cheerful, physically inept person who's always kind of bumbling around in a way we find hilarious. And that role in comedy was fulfilled, was filled by the Jew in the 19th and 18th centuries.
David is on the line now from Wellesley, Massachusetts. Hi, David. Welcome to On Point.
Hello, guys. Don't you think the greatest nerd movie of all time is Apollo 13?
How so?
The heroes of that movie are not the astronauts who are stranded in space. It's the nerds who get them back.
David, thank you. Do you agree, Benjamin?
Greatest nerd movie ever is a hard one. But yeah, that is a cool conceit. And, you know, it's kind of a tradition in science fiction movies. I think sci-fi screenwriters, kind of know who their audience are. And, you know, Independence Day is kind of, I don't think it's a great movie or anything, but kind of emblematic of that trope in sci-fi movies where the heroic jock and the nerdy engineer have to work together to save the planet from an alien.
Another comment and question from Tom in Danvers, Massachusetts. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I'm enjoying this. I'm a lifelong nerd. I was building computers in my basement in the early 60s. And I guess I'm like a revenge of the nerd guy because I did start a software company and was successful. But I have a slightly different take on it. And I don't want to sound too somber about it because I love nerds. I mean, we hired guys who swung both arms in the same direction when they walked. And, you know, we would flip coins to see who had to tell a guy he had to go home and have a shower. But I got to a point where I felt nerdiness, my nerdiness was dangerous to me and bad for my family and bad for my relationships. And I had to code less on the computer because I associate emotional health with sort of social health, and I can't separate them in my mind. So I'm not, you know, I'm charmed by nerds and I love them and I accept myself as a nerd, but I don't think it's ultimately, for a lot of nerds, a good place to stay if you have a choice to work your way out of it.
It's such an interesting comment, Tom. Thanks. Benjamin Nugent, the health perils of being a nerd.
Yeah, I think a lot of people do grow out of being nerds, which is actually one of like the really important reasons to draw a distinction between nerdiness and say, Asperger's syndrome or conditions on the autism spectrum, because one is temporary and the other is necessarily permanent. And I think it's a, you know, it's a narrative in a lot of people's lives that they start out dedicated nerds, and while those nerdy activities still remain really important to them later on, they make way for other things.
More great calls here to Steve in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Steve. Welcome to On Point.
Well, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. And all I was going to say was, I was thinking one of the great 20th century social commentaries on nerds is Arthur Miller's play, Death of a Salesman, in which, as you will know, Biff, the son, is brought up by his salesman father to despise the boy next door, who's weak, and I think I remember correctly, wore glasses, etc., etc. And yet, at the end of the play, he discovers it's the boy next door who goes on to argue a case before the Supreme Court, whereas Biff is a failure like his father.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Steve, thank you.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way of thinking about that play, and I never thought about that before, but I think that's absolutely right. Biff is such a comically anti-nerd name. And, you know, another great narrative about that kind of character are the Rabbit books by John Updike. This sense of somebody who was brought up to have a set of characteristics that made him a great athlete in high school. The rabbit character is a basketball star in his hometown in Pennsylvania, and then adult life is a disappointment for him. And I think that's actually one of the reasons nerds are resented, is that when you're in junior high with them and you're somebody for whom junior high or high school is going to be the peak experience of your life, you kind of want to take this chance to put them in their place because you sense that in the future you're going to be Biff and they're going to be arguing a case before the Supreme Court. That doesn't happen every time, of course, at all, but I think people worry about it, and it's one of the reasons they persecute nerds.
Francelle is in Spokane, Washington. Hi, Francelle. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Jane. As a logic tutor in college and an avid D&D and roleplay nerd in high school, I was wondering if the millennia-old adage that knowledge is power is one of those ideas that has brought the nerd or the geek up into more of a prominent position in our society.
Francelle, thanks. Benjamin Nugent, what do you think?
Well, the idea that knowledge is power and or I think, therefore I am, are ideas that go in and out of style. And, for example, in the Enlightenment, you could argue that the way the literate aristocracy thought about things was very much a nerdy way of seeing things, that the planets rotated perfectly in a kind of machine-like way. And you know, you could describe every phenomenon and solve every problem with logic. And then that goes out of style in the Romantic period when people are kind of trying to describe themselves as the opposite of machines. And then that comes back into style and out of style with various movements in modernity. And so I think we're at an up moment for nerds right now.
Up moment.
You know, if you look at our pop culture, for example, you get these kind of desirable nerds like Seth Cohen on The OC. And, you know, I think it's because they generate so much wealth right now. And so right now we're in a kind of knowledge is power era, and it'll be interesting to see how that changes or doesn't. Hmm.
Another thought from Mike, who's in Virginia, Newport News, Virginia. Hi, Mike. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I have a question about possible, like, music nerds. We don't think of musicians as being quite nerdy people. You know, Bruce Springsteen and people like that don't really come across as being nerds. But what about people like Weird Al Yankovic, maybe?
Hmm. Good point. Thanks, Mike.
Well, yeah, Weird Al Yankovic has definitely made a career out of being a nerd. You know, I think White and Nerdy was his most recent hit single, right? And so, yeah, I mean, there is a tradition of nerdy rock. You know, I think They Might Be Giants and Devo and Rush and Weird Al would be the first people we would think of. However, I made a point that I actually took some flack for in the New York Times in my book, where I asserted that, you know, besides those obvious examples, Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys seems like a nerd. You know, interviews who have talked to him say he talks, quote-unquote, like a voicemail menu. And he was obsessed with equipment and with creating through technical prowess these crazy sounds on albums like Pet Sounds, you know, recording in a sand pit, stuff like that. Isolating himself for long periods of time. And so I think beyond the obvious nerd rock examples, there are a lot of nerds in music.
I have a practical question for parents. What are the dilemmas facing families, parents with nerdy children? What's the best way to raise a nerdy child?
Well, there are lots of different kinds of nerds who require different kinds of upbringing. But what seems to me the most basic, important thing to keep in mind is on one hand to encourage those nerdy gifts, and on the other hand to not let nerds take social rejection so hard that they have to think of themselves as superior to everyone else. I think this vicious cycle happens in a lot of nerdy lives in adolescence, where they're rejected by their peers, and so then they decide the rest of their peers must be idiots and they're better than they are. And so their peers hate them even more for that, and it kind of goes around and around and around. And so I would say, if I had a nerdy child, you know, don't worry about it if other kids don't like you. Don't worry about it if they make fun of you for your gifts. But don't hate them for it. Just remember that this is something they have to go through to feel better about themselves. And don't think of yourself as a member of an elite nerd race.
I want to squeeze in another call here toward the end. Catherine is in Aiken, South Carolina. Hi, Catherine. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, welcome.
I just wanted to comment, you know, I am a very attractive, physically attractive person. I'm a very athletic person. I'm also a very intellectual person. And as you can imagine, there being an even more isolated place than just straight up being a nerd, like, I never fit in with anyone. Like, I never fit in with just the pretty people, and I never fit in with just the athletic people or the nerdy people. So it's kind of interesting because not only, like, I'm successful now, you know, and in my business career, but there are people even still isolated further than just being one or the other.
Catherine, thanks. Benjamin, you have a comment?
That does sound like a terrible dilemma, being both attractive and intellectual. I feel terrible, and I don't know what to tell the caller. That sounds like the lower depths.
I'm curious, who is the nerd among the presidential candidates?
I've been asked that before. You know,
you have been
asked?
Yeah.
And I used to say Hillary when she was in the running because I think she was the most obviously wonkish at the time. And I think she seemed so eager to make an emotional connection with audiences, and yet, despite that eagerness, you could sense a certain distance. Whereas Obama and McCain are both charismatic figures and are known, I think, both more for their personal stories than their policy positions, whereas Hillary, at least for a while, seemed to be the one who really rode in on policy And as much as she was trying to crack that veneer, as much as she was talking about learning how to shoot near Scranton or whatever, where she grew up, you could sense there was a certain kind of... you sense that she would rather be in a room with, you know, some Condi Rice type people talking about strategy than doing this. And that to me made her more of a nerd.
We're running out of time, but I wonder if you'd tell us what you learned from your nerdiness. What is the one lesson that you've taken into adulthood from your early childhood as a nerd?
I guess that everybody's suffering. You know? When you're a nerdy kid, I think you tend to think that your own suffering is unique, and that the people who are being mean to you are being meaner to you than they are to anybody else. And one of the things I learned researching this book was how everybody kind of thought of themselves as an outcast or downtrodden in some ways. And, you know, that nerdy experience is everybody's experience in some ways.
The book is American Nerd. The author is Benjamin Nugent. I appreciate your time today. Thanks so much.
Hey, thank you.
Good luck with the book.
Hey, thanks.
You can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast, listeners, at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. My rims never spin. To the contrary, you'll find that they're quite stationary. All of my action figures are cherry. Stephen Hawking's in my library. My MySpace page is all totally pimped out. Got people begging for my top 8 spaces. Yo, I know pie to 1,000 places. Ain't got no grills, but I still wear braces. I order all of my sandwiches with mayonnaise. I'm a whiz at Minesweeper, I can play for days. Once you see my sweet moves, you're gonna stay amazed. My fingers moving so fast, I'll set the place ablaze. There's no killer app I haven't run. At Pascal, well, I'm number one. Do vector calculus just for fun. I ain't got a gap, but I got a soldering gun. Happy Days is my favorite theme song. I could sure kick your butt in a game of ping pong. I'll ace any trivia quiz you bring on. I'm fluent in JavaScript as well as Klingon. R.I.C.